And Sigmund Freud is known as the father of psychoanalysis. He believed a person's dreams offered insights into the individual's unconscious desires and struggles. So in some cases, he believed what a person truly desired to happen would be expressed in a dream. In other cases, he believed dreams revealed a person's fears. And Freud thought that through careful analysis of the dream, the psychoanalyst could uncover the person's unconscious mind. And Freud's theories have been widely accepted and are still employed today. However, Freud is not a reliable guide to understanding the human mind or heart. He believed God is a fantasy and religion a neurosis. Those are exact words. He denied the Bible's teachings about the origin and nature of man. And so he was one of those referred to in Psalm 14. He was a fool who said in his heart, "There is no God." But despite his inability to truly understand the mind and heart of man, Freud's theories on dreams have so significantly impacted our culture that many people outside of psychology and psychiatry still look to his ideas to explain their dreams. But Freud did not begin the human fascination with dreams. People throughout history have believed their dreams revealed secrets about life and the universe, so that most of the world in the Old Testament times believed the gods spoke through dreams, especially to kings, priests, and other powerful people. And the kings employed wise men to interpret their dreams and explain to them the will of the gods. Of course, the gods of the nations are not real. Fictional beings do not know and cannot reveal the future. Figments of the imagination do not have a will, and they cannot communicate the will they do not have to other people. The interpretation of dreams was, and still is, only so much superstition. But twice in the book of Daniel, God interrupted the pagan superstitions to give genuine divine revelation through a dream. And in doing so, he rendered the professional interpreters powerless to explain the dream. Instead, God revealed his plans to King Nebuchadnezzar through his prophet Daniel. And in Daniel chapter 4, God uses the dream and the revelation of it through Daniel to warn the wicked to repent of their sin and walk in righteousness. The entirety of Daniel 4 is a decree of King Nebuchadnezzar that he sent to the entire Babylonian Empire. And that decree declares the greatness of the holy God of Daniel. And so the decree begins with a brief statement that he had a troubling dream. Verse 4, "I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at rest in my house and flourishing in my palace. I saw a dream which made me afraid, and the thoughts on my bed and the visions of my head troubled me." And then he goes on, and the king says he declares his wise men were unable to interpret the dream. So he says in verse 6, "Therefore, I issued a decree to bring in all the wise men of Babylon before me, that they might make known to me the interpretation of the dream. Then the magicians, the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers came in, and I told them the dream, but they did not make known to me its interpretation." Now, I am a little bit surprised by the inability of the counselors there to give the king a plausible interpretation of his dream. They had books and traditions which had been handed down to them, which guided their interpretations. It was a relatively static process. They had the information and they just revealed it at the right time. So, for example, if someone in a dream did something with their right hand, then that was an omen of success. But if they did something with their left hand, that was a warning of failure. And so these counselors should have been able to come up with something to tell the king about his dream. I mean, frankly, if it was my job and my life, very life depended on being able to tell the king the interpretation, I would have come up with something. Definitely. Now, I think one of the reasons they didn't tell the king what anything about his dream is I think they might have had an inkling of the meaning of the dream. If you remember from the last 2 weeks, a dream centers around a great tree that is cut down. And throughout ancient literature, we see that there was this idea of a sacred tree. It was a very familiar cultural image, so that not just the Babylonians, but the Assyrians and other people groups would have seen a great tree as representative of this sacred tree. But the sacred tree was often directly connected with the growth and well-being of the kingdom. And so for a king to dream about a great tree would be likely seen as a dream about the future of his kingdom. And if for a king to dream about the destruction of that tree would be interpreted as a sign the kingdom was going to be destroyed. Some of that is I'm assuming they had this knowledge. So I'm not saying definitely that they would have had all of this in their mind, but it seems likely. And so if they thought that the king's dream foretold the destruction of Babylon, they may have been very unwilling to answer the king. Nobody wants to tell the king that the gods have said his kingdom's going to be destroyed. Now, we know the gods didn't send this dream. God himself, the only God, sent the dream to Nebuchadnezzar. Interestingly, though, God chose these images to put in the king's head. And he very well may have used imagery familiar to the Babylonians so they would more readily accept this dream as from God. Now, I don't say that to justify or to give credibility to the superstitious and pagan practices of the king's wise men. They were believing that their gods, and Nebuchadnezzar himself believed that their gods gave these dreams and then gave them understanding of the dreams. And this dream interpretation really is no different than using a crystal ball or tarot cards today. What it is attempting to tap into the supernatural to learn secrets about the future and usually to gain guidance for life. Now, in contrast to nations like Babylon, God explicitly forbade the Israelites from participating in any form of divination. Any form at all. Because divination seeks direction from idols rather than from God. Because the idols are dumb and the gods are non-existent, all divination at its best is nothing more than the worthless imaginations of deceived and in some cases deceiving people. So the king here in verse 8 begins to intentionally contrast Daniel with all the rest of the king's wise men. He says, but at the last, Daniel came before me. His name is Belteshazzar, according to the name of my God. In him is the spirit of the holy God. And I told the dream before him, saying, Belteshazzar, chief of the magicians, because I know that the spirit of the holy God is in you, and no secret troubles you, explain to me the visions of my dream that I have seen and its interpretation. So we see in verse 9, Daniel, or Belteshazzar, as if it was his Babylonian name, is called the chief of the king's magicians. Now, don't imagine that Daniel was practicing divination like all the others were. We saw in chapter 2 how Daniel was elevated to that position so that he was able to interpret the dream Nebuchadnezzar had of the great image. Once again, that Nebuchadnezzar's counselors could not explain it to him, Daniel told the king what he dreamed and what that dream meant. And so as a result, Daniel 2:48 says, then the king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts, and made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief administrator over all the wise men of Babylon. His title was chief of the magicians. That's where he was elevated to that position. But Daniel was able to explain the dream of the king because he was a prophet of God who received direct revelation from the only true God. Daniel did not need to examine books of divination or memorize omens. He spoke to God, and God spoke to him. And that's exactly what Nebuchadnezzar confesses. In verse 9, he says, I know the Spirit of the Holy God is in you. Nebuchadnezzar recognized that something was different about Daniel. He recognized something was different about Daniel's God. Now remember, this is in the middle of a public nationwide proclamation. Nebuchadnezzar is telling all Babylon the God of Daniel is unique. He is holy. He is different from all of the gods of the Babylonians. Nebuchadnezzar told Babylon that Daniel had a unique relationship with his God, that Daniel's relationship with his God was nothing like the other wise men's relationship with their so-called gods. Nebuchadnezzar confessed that Daniel's God uniquely empowered Daniel. And it's only after telling the troublesome dream and the inability of the counselors and the confidence that he places in Daniel does the king finally tell the dream. I've discussed it last week, so I'm not going to read the verses today, but I'll just give you a quick review. You remember the king dreamed of a great tree whose height reached to the heavens, and it could be seen by all of the earth. The tree was beautiful and abundant. From the tree, all manner of people and animals found sustenance and shelter. An angel descended from heaven and commanded the tree be cut down. Its branches were chopped off, its leaves were stripped, and its fruit was scattered. A metal band was placed around the stump of that tree, and seven seasons passed over him. He was given the heart of a beast, and he lived outside without any shelter like an animal. And the angel declared in verse 17 that this decree had been decided so that the living would know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men, gives it to whomever he will, and sets over it the lowest of men. In verse 19, we see that when Daniel heard the dream, he was appalled by what it foretold. It says, Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, was astonished for a time, and his thoughts troubled him. He's overwhelmed by what he has heard, what he knows it to be foretelling. So the king spoke and said, Belteshazzar, do not let the dream or its interpretation trouble you. Belteshazzar answered and said, my lord, may the dream concern those who hate you and its interpretation concern your enemies. So the king sees Daniel's anguish. He encourages him to tell the meaning of the dream. And Daniel starts off, before he explains what the dream means, he expresses it is his desire for the dream to be about the king's enemies and not the king. Daniel is affirming his loyalty to the king and his desire for the king's well-being. And then in verses 20 to 26, Daniel explained the meaning of that dream. So let's read those verses. It says, the tree that you saw, which grew and became strong, whose height reached to the heavens, and which could be seen by all the earth, whose leaves were lovely, and its fruit abundant, and which was food for all, under which the beast of the field dwelt, and in whose branches the birds of the heaven had their home. It is you, O king, who have grown and become strong, for your greatness has grown and reaches to the heavens, and your dominion to the end of the earth. And inasmuch as the king saw a watcher, a holy one, coming down from heaven and saying, chop down the tree and destroy it, but leave its stump and roots in the earth, bound with a band of iron and bronze in the tender grass of the field. Let it be wet with the dew of heaven, and let him graze with the beast of the field till seven times pass over him. This is the interpretation, O king, and this is the decree of the Most High, which has come upon my lord the king. They shall drive you from men. Your dwelling shall be with the beast of the field. They shall make you eat grass like oxen. They shall wet you with the dew of heaven, and seven times shall pass over you, till you know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomever he chooses. And as much as they gave the command to leave the stump and roots of the tree, your kingdom shall be assured to you after you come to know that heaven rules. So verse 22, it is you, O king. This dream is about Nebuchadnezzar. It's not about the kingdom of Babylon. It's about the king himself. And like in chapter 2, the dream here begins with the greatness of Nebuchadnezzar. He had grown, and his kingdom was spread far. The entire world was affected by Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom. However, while the tree was still green and thriving, it was cut down, and its stump was left in the field. The destruction of the king would come, the destruction of the tree would come on the king. He would be cut down in the midst of his power, stripped of his glory, and left out in the field. They would drive Nebuchadnezzar from men. Now, we don't know who the they are. It could have been powerful people close to the king. I think it is more likely that an unseen hand, the hand of God through an angel, filled the king with madness and drove him out of his palace. But regardless of who that they are, the dream foretold the king would be driven outside. He would live with the beast of the field. Now, he's not roughing it. This is not a prolonged camping trip where he has a tent and he is intentionally doing without some of the amenities of his palace. He would live like a wild animal. He did not sleep under a shelter. He did not sit at a table to eat. He did not bathe. He did not practice any sort of basic hygiene. He would be in all respects like a wild animal, even just eating of the vegetation of the fields. And the king would stay in that bestial state until he learned who was really in charge. However, though Nebuchadnezzar would be humiliated, he would not lose his kingdom. Just like the stump of the tree would be preserved, so the kingdom would be preserved for Nebuchadnezzar after he learned, verse 26, that heaven rules. After explaining this dream to Nebuchadnezzar, Daniel exercised his role as the king's counselor. Verse 27, he says, therefore, O king, let my advice be acceptable to you. Break off your sins by being righteous and your iniquities by showing mercy to the poor. Perhaps there may be a lengthening of your prosperity. So Daniel advised the king to do what he can to avoid that prophesied judgment. He counseled the king to break off his sins. That word translated break off is it's a strong one. It's suggesting the king take violent and dramatic action to remove his sin from him. It's not something he's just kind of gradually ease into, but he's supposed to lop it off right now. And the king was to cut off his sins by being righteous. Righteousness is conformity to the law of God. So Daniel is counseling King Nebuchadnezzar to submit himself to the rule of Israel's God and to obey the commands of Daniel's God. Daniel here then gives the king specific instructions on how to put aside his sins. He says to break off your iniquities by showing mercy to the poor. He's instructing the king to change his ways because oppression of the poor and taking advantage of the weak has a long history. Really, since the beginning of history, powerful people have mistreated those that they could get away with mistreating. We see that actually in Genesis 4 with a man named Lamech. who kills men simply for insulting him because he was powerful and they were not. The poor suffered greatly throughout history at the hands of nobles, lords, kings, and emperors. And Nebuchadnezzar was no different from the majority of the world leaders. He oppressed and mistreated the poor. He forced them to work as his slaves. He offered no help to those who were unable to provide for themselves. He distorted justice in favor of the rich and the powerful. And Daniel advised this unjust king to show kindness and pity to the poor, which is striking to me because Daniel is a slave. He was dragged out of his home in Jerusalem, forced to march to Babylon, and he's remaining a slave. Even though he has a high position, he is not free. He remains the slave of Nebuchadnezzar. There's every reason for Daniel to want nothing but harm to come on Nebuchadnezzar. But he does not respond with vengeance. He counseled the king to do that which was truly best for the king and his kingdom. He offers Nebuchadnezzar a way to possibly avoid the dire judgment. And in this humility and generosity of Daniel, we also see God's mercy. In fact, God's mercy is evident throughout this chapter. The humiliation of Nebuchadnezzar was intense. I suspect the king suffered lifelong effects from his time in the fields. That judgment was severe, but God was not maliciously inflicting pain on Nebuchadnezzar just because he could. God had a good purpose in his judgment of the king. And he provided Nebuchadnezzar warning and a way to avoid wrath. God positioned Daniel in the court of the king. God sent the dream to Nebuchadnezzar. God revealed to Daniel the meaning of the dream. God guided Daniel to exhort the king to repent of his sin. God showed the king, and as a result, the entire kingdom of Babylon, great mercy. He gave them an opportunity to turn to him. Despite God's mercy, the king did not heed Daniel's advice. Verse 28, to the point, all this came upon King Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar did not break off his sin. He did not show any mercy to the poor. He continued in his arrogant pride. And he suffered the consequences of his rebellion. So verse 29 tells us at the end of 12 months, he was walking about the royal palace of Babylon. The king spoke, saying, "Is not this great Babylon that I have built for a royal dwelling by my mighty power and for the honor of my majesty?" So Nebuchadnezzar is walking around his palace and he is content. He is considering the majesty of the great city which he had built. And he was satisfied. He was self-satisfied. Now Babylon at that time truly was majestic. Now it's nothing but a pile of rubble. But at the time it was majestic. It was the largest city in the world at that time. And Nebuchadnezzar was responsible for the growth of that city. During his reign, the walls of the city, it were expanded to cross the Euphrates River. And so that Babylon doubled in size. Nebuchadnezzar expanded the palace to be greater than any that had been built by his predecessors. The city of Babylon was home to two great temples. There was a massive ziggurat, essentially a pyramid, a stepped pyramid, that dominated the skyline. The primary gate of the city is known as the Ishtar Gate. It was a majestic fortification. It's very castle-like in its structure. It stood nearly 40 feet tall. The entire gate was glazed with a brilliant blue paint, and it was decorated with these bulls and lions, again painted with gold. It was accented with golden lines. And under Nebuchadnezzar's reign, Babylon had become the most impressive and powerful city in the known world. And when he walked around his palace, he could look out upon the greatest city in the world, and the king knew he had made it greater. He was content and satisfied with his own greatness, and so he says, "Is not this Babylon, great Babylon, that I have built for a royal dwelling by my mighty power and for the honor of my majesty?" Before the king even finished speaking, judgment was pronounced. Verse 31, while the word was still in the king's mouth, a voice fell from heaven, "King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken. The kingdom has departed from you, and they shall drive you from men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. They shall make you eat grass like oxen, and seven times shall pass over you, until you know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomever he chooses." That very hour, the word was fulfilled concerning Nebuchadnezzar. Judgment fell. He was driven out. He spent seven seasons living like an animal. And it was only when he learned that heaven rules that he was restored to his kingdom. God used this incredible method to teach the king to repent of his sin and submit to God's rule. As we go to this chapter, we see particularly in verse 27 in Daniel's exhortation, in verse 30 in Nebuchadnezzar's boast, we see four ways that people rebel against the rule of God. First of all, sin, all sin, is a sweeping denial of God's rule. Second, the mistreatment of the poor denies God's rule. Third, believing your achievements or your own accomplishments denies God's rule. And fourth, the exaltation of your own excellence denies God's rule. First, all sin denies God's rule. Sin is always an assertion your will for your life is the one which matters most. It is a declaration, I decide how I live. So whether the sin is big or small, it is always declaring that I'm the final rule here, not God. And one very famous example is King Saul's disobedience when he did not wipe out the Amalekites and all their livestock. When he was confronted on it, Saul tried to shift the blame onto the people. And then he claimed they kept the best of the livestock to offer as a sacrifice to God. And in 1 Samuel 15:23, the prophet Samuel told King Saul, "Rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is as iniquity and idolatry. You have rejected the word of the Lord." So God declared through Samuel that rebellion, the refusal to obey him, is like witchcraft and idolatry. Witchcraft and idolatry turn to demons and to created things for direction or blessing or security. There is no greater disavowal of God's rule than turning from him to evil spirits, powerless creatures, and vain imaginations. Samuel says, God tells us through Samuel that disobedience to God is always rebellion. It is always the rejection of God's rule. So that every sin denies God is sovereign over your life. Second, the mistreatment of the poor denies God's rule. The book of Proverbs says, "He who oppresses the poor reproaches his maker." Another proverb says, "He who mocks the poor reproaches his maker." So that in both cases, the mistreatment of the poor is specifically said to be a reproach against God. In the first of those two proverbs, Solomon sets reproaches his maker in contrast with honors him. So that the one who mistreats the poor dishonors God. He defames and defies God. That poor man was created in the image of God, and to oppress or persecute that image bearer is to defame and deface the image of God. The oppressor disregards the greatness and the glory of God. He disputes and denies God's care for the poor. He denies that God executes justice. Proverbs 22 says, "Do not rob the poor because he is poor, nor oppress the afflicted at the gate, for the Lord will plead their cause and plunder the soul of those who plunder them." What that proverb says is that God himself will prosecute the oppressor of the poor. Those who mistreat the poor denies that God is that effective judge or prosecutor. The mistreatment of the weak and the helpless and the poor denies that God cares for the poor, that God rules all men, and that he exacts justice from men. The one who mistreats the poor believes his desires matter more than the commands of God or the image of God born in that person. The mistreater of the weak thinks he can get away with oppression because the poor are powerless, and he acts as if God does not sovereignly hold all men accountable to himself. The mistreatment of the poor is a denial of the rule of God. Believing your achievements are your own also denies God's rule. The self-satisfaction which looks around at your successes and claims them as entirely your own is an outright denial that you are a dependent creature. When you think you have accomplished something by your own strength, intellect, skill, or ability, then you deny the God who sustains you. In Acts 17, it says that in God we live, move, and have our being, and he gives to all life, breath, and all things. Job 12, verse 10 says, God holds in his hand the life of every living thing and the breath of all mankind. If God holds life and breath in his hand, then the most basic necessities of our continued existence are in his control. If I cannot breathe apart from God, how can I do any other thing? How can you think, move, speak, write, build, make, or operate apart from God? And when you achieve something, it is only because God sustained your life and because God gave you the skill necessary to accomplish that. Claiming the achievement as your own, as by your mighty power, denies that God is sovereign over every aspect of your life. And then finally, the exaltation of your own glory denies God's rule. Nebuchadnezzar thought he built Babylon by his own power to bring honor to his own majesty. Daniel has already told us that was not why Nebuchadnezzar built Babylon. God raised up Nebuchadnezzar. God gave Nebuchadnezzar great successes. God made Nebuchadnezzar a mighty king. Nebuchadnezzar built great Babylon because God enabled him to do those things so the honor of God's majesty would be exalted. And when we attempt to exalt our own glory, we take glory from God, at least we attempt to. We act as if we are the ones in ultimate control who deserve the ultimate praise. And to seek your own praise is to think that God had little to do with giving you the talent or the place and the time and the opportunity to succeed. To exalt your own honor is to think you are an entirely independent deity who is able to do all things in and of yourself. And we probably don't explicitly think that, but that is what we are doing. We are acting as if we possess all power to do all we will. We deny that God rules when we act as if we deserve the praise for what we do. So how do we avoid these errors? How do we submit to God's rule of our individual lives? Well, first, very obvious, very simple. Well, simple to state. Do not sin. Intentionally and daily submit control of your life to God. His word tells you how to live, act, feel, and think in every circumstances. Do what God tells you to do. And if you know that you are habitually practicing a particular sin, break it off. Cut off that sin from your life. Take whatever steps necessary so that you will stop committing that sin. Just submit to God. Do not sin. Second, do not scorn, neglect, or mistreat those who are physically, politically, socially, or financially weaker than we. Be generous to those who have genuine needs. Seek ways to help the addicts and those who have habits of bad decisions. Look to provide genuine benefit to the poor. Protect the weak and the helpless. Love others selflessly because they carry in themselves a reflection of the glorious likeness of God. And then finally, number three, give God the glory for all you do. It's really that simple. When others praise you, point their praise to God. Give Him the credit for your successes. Remember and consciously remind yourself that you are dependent on Him for all things. Seek to exalt His honor, not your own, so that you consciously, verbally, and habitually submit your life to God's rule.